Ms. Clerk, please call the first case.
Priest versus Clark and others, Vishal Agraharker, Jerry Greenspan, Andrea Lynn Fenster, Appellants Counsel, Andrew N. Ferguson, Solicitor General, Graham K. Bryant, Deputy Solicitor General, Appellees Counsel.
Morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please this court. My name is Vishal Agraharker. I'm with the ACLU of Virginia, and I'm representing the petitioner, Stephen Patrick Priest. And with me at the counsel's table is my colleague, Jerry Greenspan. Your Honors, this case presents a straightforward issue of statutory construction, where we have a clear and unambiguous statute that uses precise language, but which respondents have chosen to interpret in a way that adds language to the statute that's nowhere in the text. In 2020, the General Assembly amended the Earned Sentence Credit Statute to increase the number of good time credits that are available to people who are incarcerated in Virginia prisons who have demonstrated good behavior and have worked to rehabilitate themselves while incarcerated. The General Assembly made those increased credits available to, in their words, any offense other than those enumerated in subsection A of the relevant section. Those offenses in subsection A include some inchoate offenses and not others. And the question before this court is whether that list should be interpreted in accordance with its plain meaning, or whether it should instead encompass all attempts, solicitations, and conspiracies to commit any of the offenses listed, including those like Mr. Priest's that are not listed. We would submit that the answer to that question, based upon a straightforward application of well-established principles of statutory construction, is that the plain language of the statute should control. Now, this court has been clear in case after case, including just last year in Appalachian Power Company versus State Corporation Commission, that we determine legislative intent by what a statute says and not by what we think it should have said.
The statute in combination with 531.202.3 is at least a little inartful. It refers to it, not necessarily your client's attempt at murder under 18.2-31, but it refers to a violation of 18.2-32. And given that that's a punishment statute, I don't know how a citizen violates 18.2-32. It seems to me that at best we have to incorporate the elements of common law murder to constitute a violation of 18.2-32. Would you agree with that?
No, Your Honor, or at least that it...
It's a relatively friendly question.
The statute incorporates 18.2-32, Mr. Priest was convicted of an attempt at that provision.
And as I said, I understand that that's one argument, which may be a very good argument for a case, but I'm a little more concerned about the statute more broadly. To the extent that one can violate 18.2-32, it would require one to satisfy the elements of common law murder, correct?
Yes, that's right.
All right. And that necessarily, by definition, involves a dead person.
Yes.
And we don't have one here.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. We don't have a dead person here. And I would point this court to the way the General Assembly refers to inchoate offenses throughout the code. And we have examples throughout the code where, when the General Assembly means to, it very explicitly refers to inchoate offenses. And it specifically says, and we point to a few examples of this on page 7 of our reply brief, but there are many more. I would point this court, for example, to, and this one wasn't in our brief, but it's section 9.1-902. This is the code section on criminal offense registries and registries for crimes against minors. And there, the statute provides that the offenses that require you to register upon release from prison include any violation of, attempted violation of, or conspiracy to violate various code sections, including things, including actually the offense at issue here, at least where that's committed against a minor. That's exactly the type of phrasing that could have been in the statute and would have been in the statute if it was intended to cover Mr. Priest's offense. But it isn't in the statute. But while we do have mentions in the statute of subsection A to solicitation to commit murder, the combination of those two makes clear that This is the kind of case where this court has consistently applied the negative implication canon, where some things are in the in a list of the statute that's provided in the statute, and other things aren't. That this court is required to presume that the choices made by the General Assembly about what to include and exclude were intentional.
You're making a classical textualist argument, are you not?
I am. This is the canons that we would say are most applicable here are just the ordinary plain meaning canon and the negative implication canon. This court has consistently and dependably applied those canons in cases like this, especially with enumerated provisions like this.
So whether this is good or bad public policy is not before the court.
That's absolutely right. That was before the legislature when it drafted this, and we don't know what was in the minds of the various legislators that decided what things to include and what things to exclude. What we're left with, and what this court is left with, is what's in the text of this statute. That's how it determines legislative intent under Tvardek.
Probably the better way to say it is that's how we ascribe legislative intent.
That's right. And I think in Tvardek, for example, the way this court articulated that was we don't ask what the legislature meant, we ask what the statute means. And they were, it said this exact same thing in three or four different ways, more artfully than I could, but we're left with the same thing. We're not looking at or concerned with the policy implications of any of this.
We quoted that, but it was actually Oliver Wendell Holmes who said it.
I believe that's right. And I just didn't go that far back in the research, but I think that's exactly right. So just turning to the response argument about the phrase any violation of. They place a lot of weight on the word any, that because it says any violation of this offense, that necessarily encompasses things that are not listed. So we would submit that that is, again, that's not how the General Assembly has used that word anywhere else in the code. In the statute that I mentioned earlier, 9.1-902, it uses any violation of.
But even if any is given the broadest possible interpretation, you still need to have a violation of the statute, which, for example, 18.2-32 would seem to require a dead body.
That's right. You can't, any can only bear so much weight. What it can't bear is that any violation of a certain statute cannot encompass something that is not in that code section.
It is not a violation of that statute.
Exactly. That's exactly right, Your Honor, and I guess further support for this, which isn't needed, but the statute also says that for any offense other than those that are listed in subsection A, the enhanced earned credit system applies. So if you're going to read the word any so broadly, we would submit far too broadly than that word can bear, it also would have to be read the other way. Because subsection B, which is the structure of this statute, creates this presumption that these earned sentence credits apply unless you're in one of these code sections, and this one isn't. Your Honor, just to turn briefly to the absurdity argument, anti-absurdity canon, which respondents raise. They rely on this canon. Again, this is, another way of saying what this court said in the cases that I cited, Tvardek, Appalachian Power Company, which is that the word absurdity has a very narrow legal definition that isn't applicable here. Basically, absurdity is used only when a particular interpretation renders a statute incapable of operation or causes some kind of irreconcilable conflict. Neither of those cases applicable. There's no suggestion anywhere in the record that that awarding Mr. Priest the credits that he earned would cause the statute to cease to operate. And in fact, a response concede that the department was ready to let him go last July, at least until presumably until the Attorney General's opinion came down that reversed its earlier opinion. So this is completely capable of operation. It just doesn't fit within how this court has articulated that canon. And it said in that along the same lines that because a litigant or a court believes that an interpretation is unwise, improper, or inequitable, that's not absurd. Your Honors, at the end of the day, there are many ways that the General Assembly could have clearly articulated that Mr. Priest's offense was excluded. It could have said, for example, attempts to commit a Class 1 felony under 18.2-25, in much the same way that it listed solicitation to commit murder under 18.29, that was excluded. It could have said attempted violations of 18.2-31, the aggravated murder statute, and that is that's basically the exact language that it used in section 9.1-902, the statute I mentioned earlier about the sex offense and crimes against minor registry. It could have simply specified that all attempts, solicitations, and conspiracies related to any of these offenses were themselves excluded, as it has done in several other code sections, which we're happy to list off. The point is there are many ways that the legislature could have clearly explained that this particular offense is excluded from eligibility, and the legislature remains free to amend the statute to do so. But until it does, neither respondents nor any court can read language into the statute that isn't there. Your Honors, this is a very straightforward case. The statute makes any offenses other than those that are listed in subsection A eligible for these enhanced earned sentence credits. Mr. Priest's offense is not listed in subsection A, and there's no basis to read language in the statute that the General Assembly did not include. And we know that the General Assembly knows how to specify inchoate offenses when it means to. Now, respondents are asking this court to work backwards from their policy preferences, from their assumptions about what the true intent of the General Assembly was in passing this law, and from their beliefs about what should have been included in the first place. But that's not how this court operates, and which is to start from the text. And the text in this case is very clear that Mr. Priest is entitled to these credits. Unless there are any further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. You have 3 minutes and 25 seconds left.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Andrew Ferguson on behalf of the director. I'm joined at council table by Deputy Solicitor General Graham Bryant. In July 2012, Stephen Priest, after beating his wife, tried to murder two police officers with an AK-47. He pleaded guilty to attempted murder of police officers and was sentenced to prison. He's asked this court today to grant a petition for a writ of habeas corpus, releasing him early from prison. This court should deny the petition. The straightforward textual clues of this statute indicate that the legislature did, in fact, intend to and successfully covered attempt crimes like the one at issue here.
He was convicted of attempting to violate 18.2-31, correct?
Yes, Justice Russell.
That doesn't appear anywhere in the list of excluded crimes, does it? Your brief refers to 18.32, but that's not what he was.
So I have a couple responses, Justice Russell, and I would also like to take up the question that you asked my friend on the other side earlier. And actually, if I could start with the one you asked my friend on the other side.
I'd be fine.
Your first question to my friend on the other side was, don't we need a dead body to prove a violation of the murder statutes?
Dead body is incorrect. We need a dead person. You don't need the body.
Fair enough. Fair enough, Justice Russell. I think the answer to that question is no, and if you'll allow me to explain, I'll use the judgments of conviction in this case to explain why. The statute says that it's any violation of the murder statutes enumerated. In this case, for example, the statutes that he was adjudged to have violated by the circuit court were the attempt statute, to be sure, and also the underlying criminal statute.
Well, and this is one of the difficulties in my very first question. You can't violate 18.2.25 or 26. It's a punishment statute. It's a common law offense, right?
18.25 is the one that defines the punishment for attempt, so yes.
Right, and 18.2-32 also is a punishment statute.
Well, it is a punishment statute, but it does expressly describe what the elements are for someone who's going to be punished. It says a premeditated murder.
Well, right, but it doesn't give the elements of murder.
That's true, but I think because it's clearly intended to codify the common law, it by the use of the phrase premeditated and deliberate, which are the elements of first-degree murder, I think it does, in fact, incorporate the elements.
Well, now back to my question. Isn't there another element that requires a dead person?
So I agree in order for the completed crime of first-degree murder to be proved, a dead person is required. But the question is whether you can violate that statute without proving the dead person. And at least the way that the lower courts have understood it, including Fletcher, for example, the Court of Appeals that we cited, When someone commits an attempt of a crime, it violates both the underlying substantive offense statute, like 18-2.32, and the attempt statute. And that's exactly how the circuit judge in this case also understood it. In the judgment of conviction, the circuit judge says that he violated both 18.2-31 and 18.2-25. And so I think that any violation would encompass attempts, because that's certainly how lower courts understand it. When you commit an attempt, you are violating both the attempt statute and the underlying statute. And
even though you haven't committed all the elements necessary for a conviction.
Necessary for a conviction of the completed crime, but for centuries it's been understood that attempt is a sort of species of liability for the underlying crime. That's how attempt emerged at the common law. It was always understood as a way of getting at the underlying intention as a species of liability for the underlying crime. So I agree, there's no way that we could sustain our position if we were arguing that he had completed or he committed the completed offense of first degree murder. There's no dead person. I totally agree with that, Justice Russell. But the question is whether he committed any violation of the underlying statutes. And in our view, and it's sustained by the cases we cited, someone who commits an attempt is understood by the courts to have violated both the underlying substantive statute and the attempt statute. And the judgments of conviction in this case bear it out. Both are cited as the statutes that Mr. Priest violated in this case.
But if I'm not mistaken, the attempt under 26 is a felony four, is that right?
That's right, Justice Kelsey.
Obviously, murder is a felony one.
That's right, Justice Kelsey.
So obviously that's gradation of punishment, but that doesn't make it a different crime, a different conviction?
Well, so it is true for purposes of Blockberger, for example, this is a different crime, and I'm not denying that. What I'm saying is that beginning at common law when attempt emerged in England in the 16th or 17th century and carrying through to today, although attempt was certainly understood to be a separate crime, it was also understood to be a species of the underlying crime, which is why every state in the Union, including the Commonwealth, merges attempt into the underlying offense. One cannot be convicted of the underlying offense and of an attempt, even though under Blockberger, you absolutely could. You could separate them out, but the common law never has, and the reason for that is because attempt emerged as a form of species of liability of the underlying crime, which is why I think when the legislature says any violation of the underlying statutes, there's no reason whatsoever not to read that to include the violation in the form of the attempt, which, yes, also violates the attempt statute. But the attempt statute, as Justice Russell has pointed out, doesn't lay out any elements. The elements always have to require reference back to the underlying statute.
So in Virginia, suppose for the sake of argument, we didn't have a 26 attempt statute, and we had a murder punishment statute. We would revert to the common law to tell us the inchoate crime, and it would be attempt, but it would still be a different crime.
I agree with everything you said, Justice Kelsey. I just don't think that that answers the question for purposes of Virginia's law about whether an attempt to commit the underlying statute is itself a violation of that statute.
If you're right about attempt, if everything you said is correct, then the inclusion of solicitation is wholly superfluous.
I don't agree with that, Justice Russell, for the following reason, and it's why we resist the negative implication argument that my friend on the other side has made. Negative implication, as a form of clue about what the legislature intended, tells us that when we have a group of like things, and some from that group are selected in the statute and others are omitted, the ones that are omitted should, quite fairly understood, to have been intentionally omitted. But the first question for negative implication is, are the things we're proposing to compare to each other for purposes of the inclusio exclusio canon alike? And I think the answer here is they aren't alike. There are lots of places in the code where, for reasons that escape me, the General Assembly has elected to separately define, and sometimes to separately define, the elements of certain inchoate crimes. And like we argued in our brief, the failure to expressly include those separately enumerated and codified inchoate crimes would make it very difficult for me to sustain the position here if that's what we were debating. If there was a separately enumerated attempt crime in our law that wasn't expressly included in here, given the inclusion of other separately enumerated attempt crimes, I would agree the inclusio exclusio canon would probably operate to keep that one out. But I don't think it's fair to compare the general attempt statutes with the separately enumerated and codified attempt statutes. They simply aren't alike.
An argument you make regarding the solicitation being included in the excluded offenses is that it wouldn't make sense to punish solicitation more harshly than attempt. But for the actual punishment of the offenses, the General Assembly has expressly done that, hasn't it?
So two responses to that. The first is, that's an argument about ultimately, this is an argument about what the text actually says. And we use that, and we stand by that, as an argument not to read the text to say what my friends on the other side say, because there's no rational explanation for why the General Assembly would have chosen to punish solicitation.
Well, but that's my question. Under Code Section 18.2-32, murder in the first degree is defined as a Class 2 felony. I'm right so far?
Yes, Justice Russell.
And that meaning attempt, as defined in 18.2-26(1) to commit that murder is a Class 4 felony, as Justice Kelsey referenced earlier, correct?
Yes, Justice Russell.
Then on 18.10, that's punishable by a maximum sentence of 2 to 10 years in the penitentiary.
Yes.
Solicitation under 18.229 to commit that same first-degree murder is an unclassified felony punishable by 5 to expressly explicit text. General Assembly says punish that by 5 to 40 years in prison.
So
a much longer maximum sentence, a much longer minimum sentence. So the General Assembly has made expressly the policy choice you say that they couldn't possibly have intended.
So I disagree with the premise in the following sense. We're here on attempted, formerly capital murder. Again, at the time...
Which isn't listed anywhere in the statute at all. 18.231 doesn't appear in 52 at all.
I agree that the code section does not appear. I have two responses to that. The first is, it is a Class 1 felony, and paragraph 1 of 53.1-202.3 says a Class 1 felony.
But what does it say? Conviction of a Class 1 felony.
That's right.
And we all agree he was not convicted of a Class 1 felony.
I agree with that. The point being, Justice Russell, that the question is whether they intended to cover solicitation of first-degree murder more harshly than attempting to murder a police officer. And our view is that there's no reason to read the text to read that, because it's not a rational accounting of the legislature's policy judgment. But again, that isn't ultimately, like Justice Kelsey said to my friend on the other side, that isn't ultimately what we're here to decide. We're here to decide what the text says. And I think that any violation of the murder statutes necessarily encompasses the unenumerated attempt violations. And certainly, that's how the lower courts understand it. When you commit a violation, an attempt crime, relying on the general attempt statutes, you have violated the general attempt statute, and you have violated the underlying substantive law.
Assume for me that 18.32 was not purely a punishment statute. It actually set out statutorily the elements of murder. Could you say that somebody violated that statute if they didn't commit all of the elements?
I wouldn't be here if I did, again, because I don't think, Justice Russell, we can or should read 18.32 and paragraph 2 of the underlying statute we're here about today solipsistically. It has to be read in light of the entire law, and when anyone is convicted of an attempt relying on the general attempt statutes, they have violated the general attempt statute and the underlying law, which is true in this case. The statutes that the circuit court adjudged him to have violated were the underlying substantive law, attempt at murdering a police officer, and the attempt statute, which is consistent with how the common law always understood attempts, which is a species of violation of the underlying substantive law. Unless the court has any questions, I'd like to address very briefly one of the arguments my friend on the other side made about amending the statute. So again, our position here today is that the statute doesn't need any amending, that its text quite plainly covers Mr. Priest's convictions. But I want to clarify sort of what's at stake and some of the difficulties that amending the statute might propose. If this court were to disagree with the director today and were to hold that Mr. Priest's convictions weren't covered, I do expect there would be a push to amend the statute to cover someone who attempts to murder police officers with an AK-47. But my friends on the other side have argued in a separate appeal that this court has granted for next term that the Constitution disables the legislature from amending the statute for anyone who was sentenced before this law went into effect. So it is, in fact, impossible on the view they have taken in another appeal this court will hear next term.
With all due respect, is that something we should be even thinking about?
Why don't we just stick to the task at hand?
I totally agree, Justice Kelsey. I'm merely pushing back on my friend's argument that if the legislature's worried about this, they can simply amend it. Their position is, actually, you couldn't amend it for Mr. Priest in a separate case. And the other point I want to make, again...
Their position for a different client, that's not their
I totally agree, Justice Russell. The point being that there isn't a clean shot way to amend this statute to cover Mr. Priest himself or the tens of thousands of prisoners who like him.
I appreciate your answering his argument, but as Justice Kelsey said, that issue should not be something that we consider.
I agree. The question here is the text, and we think that the text unambiguously covers Mr. Priest's convictions for the reasons that we stated on the at argument today and in our brief. And unless the court has any additional questions, we ask that the petition for a writ of habeas corpus be denied.
Thank you, counsel. You have 3 minutes and 25 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. My friend on the other side makes a lot of the fact that, or this idea that when someone is convicted, their order of conviction, order of sentencing lists not just the statute relating to attempts, 18.26, or the code provision on the inchoate offense, but also the underlying offense. That doesn't mean that they were convicted of the underlying offense. It does list the completed offense on the order of conviction, but it just doesn't mean that Mr. Priest was convicted of attempted aggravated murder and not the completed offense. And furthermore, and perhaps more importantly, this is just not how the General Assembly refers throughout the code to attempts. Now, I mentioned we have three examples on page 7 of our reply brief on other code provisions where the General Assembly expressly distinguishes between completed and inchoate offenses. I mentioned 9.1-902. I would point this court to 17.1-805C relating to sentencing guidelines where it defines violent felony offenses to include any violation of various completed offenses, and then separately any conspiracy or attempt to commit any offense specified in this subsection. This is the general practice that the General Assembly has used throughout the code to distinguish between attempts and completed offenses. Of course, they're also sentenced differently. So it wouldn't make sense for the General Assembly, just for the purpose of this statute, starting to define the word any in a completely different way. It would potentially call into question the way that that term and the way that that phrase is used throughout the rest of the code. And there's no basis in this statute to draw out the distinction that they're trying to make between standalone and other offenses. It's not in the text. We couldn't find that distinction articulated in anywhere in the Virginia Code or in Virginia case law. So this is a new distinction to try to get out from under the application of the negative implication canon that this court has said is dependably, consistently applied when interpreting statutes containing lists such as this. Unless there are any other questions on any of the issues, I think I don't have anything else, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Please call the next case.
McKeithen versus City of Richmond, R. Kevin Kennedy, Warner F. Young III, Appellant's Counsel, Gregory A. Lukanuski, Deputy City Attorney, Appellee's Counsel.
Good morning, may it please the court.
Hold up just a second, please, counsel. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Warner Young. I'm here with my co-counsel, Mr. R. Kevin Kennedy. We are here on behalf of the Caldwell Trust, Mr. McKeithen, the trustee. Caldwell Trust had a lien on a piece of property that was subject to a tax lien by the City of Richmond. That judgment lien was granted and is part of the protected privacy rights under the state of Virginia, particularly under statute 801, 459, and 462, which established that a judgment lien is an interest in the property. Property rights include more than just an interest in the real estate. And while it is clear that a lien is not an interest in the actual real estate, it is an interest in property protected under both the U.S. Constitution, the Fifth Amendment, as well as the Virginia Constitution. It's also recognized throughout Virginia's history in the cases that have been cited in our brief, including the two administrator cases, McClanahan and Neff's administrator. In fact, in Neff's, the statement is that the judgment lien is a charge on the equity of a sale and that that is settled law.
Prior to your client having any type of executable interest, both the tax lien by statute, which goes to the first position, and the deed of trust in the first position must be satisfied, extinguished. They have to go away.
Correct.
It seems to me that the trial court made at least an implicit finding that the deed in first position was, the deed of trust in first position had a lien of $14,000.
Well, the documents would indicate that the lien was filed in the amount of $14,000.
But to proceed as it did, the trial court had to accept that there was a $14,000 lien, or they wouldn't have been able to give you the $7,100 and whatever at the beginning.
At the beginning.
You haven't challenged that factual finding that there was a $14,000 lien. Neither of your assignments of error attack that as a factual finding, correct?
No, that is not correct, I don't believe. I'd have to pull out the assignments again if I can, but I can point to throughout the brief.
I understand that there's argument. My question is, does either of your assignments of error say the trial court erred in finding there was a $14,000 lien on the property?
Your Honor, I'm assuming that you've read that more carefully, and the answer to that is the assignment does not.
All right.
Do I think that solves or answers the ultimate question? No.
But I do think, and I agree with you on that, but I think it frames it. If we assume there's a $14,000 first priority lien ahead of you, until it is satisfied or extinguished, you have no property interest that's executable.
We have a property interest, and I think this is also finding in the recent Supreme Court case, the Tyler case of Hennepin County in Minnesota, we have a property interest in the equity that was available under the property.
If the statute read differently, if it said under your theory and assuming the $14,000 deed of trust being superior, if the statute provided that the city had to hold it, that $14,000 is unclaimed property indefinitely, would you have any takings argument whatsoever?
Yes. You cannot, by state law, and again, this is clearly mandated by the U.S. Supreme Court, particularly in the Phillips case.
If the city had to hold it for the first deed of trust holder?
The first deed of trust holder, if it had to be held in perpetuity, perhaps we wouldn't. However, at that point, we could have come in and contested the lien.
But under 3967, does the city of Richmond have an ordinance that allows them the unfettered government discretion to satisfy the Jones lien?
To satisfy, I'm sorry, I could not hear.
The Jones lien? The first lien?
The city ordinance would be, of course, subservient to what the state law is.
The statute permits the city to keep the money and to give it to the first lien or that didn't show up within the first 2 years.
Correct.
If in their merciful judgment they decide to give it, but there's no requirement that the government give it to the Jones lien.
However, and I can appreciate the argument, what I suggest is that the first liener did not come in and prove the actual existence of the lien.
I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm in part agreeing with one part of your argument, which is that if the $14,000 had been held like an interpleader case for an unknown beneficiary and it had not been extinguished or it had not been abandoned in any way, then of course there'd have to be an adjudication of whether or not that lien is valid, because your lien is on the property, it's not on any cash. So on the entire property.
Correct.
We wouldn't have subordinate liens and priority liens if we weren't talking about the same race in common law or inequity. But the question I'm asking you is, in the city of Richmond, is there an ordinance, because the statute refers to an ordinance, that says to the city of Richmond, after you guys take this money, which you have absolutely no claim to otherwise, it's no claim to the $14,000 of the city of Richmond, you can give it back to the Jones people if they show up late after the 2 years. But you don't have to, and you can only do it if you have an ordinance saying that you can. So question, do they have such an ordinance?
Do they have to?
Do they have such an ordinance?
Again, Your Honor, I'm assuming that you've read the ordinance, and that's precisely what it says. However,
the ordinance or the statute?
The statute does not say that.
Okay. Well, I think Justice Kelsey's question goes to the last sentence of the statute, and it seems to me that if the first lien holder were to show up and say, we'd like our $14,000, the city council, under the statute, could adopt an ordinance right then and there and grant them the $14,000. Do you agree with that?
The last sentence, I'm sorry?
Upon request of the former owner, his heirs or assigns or unknown beneficiary of any real estate sold under this article, and after a showing of prior entitlement thereto, the governing body of any county or city which has received such surplus funds may in its discretion grant relief by ordinance to such former owner, heir or assign or unknown beneficiary and pay over such amount as the governing body may deem appropriate to such former owner, heir, assign or unknown beneficiary.
They would have to show a prior right to be repaid.
The lien.
Correct. They would have to show that that hadn't been satisfied or that it still remained to be paid. So if we look at that question from the issue of, let's say they're given an opportunity to come forward and they don't come forward again, does it sit in perpetuity?
Well,
the more central question, in this case, the city of Richmond took it. It took the $14,000.
Well, this sentence assumes they've taken it. It says they've taken it. The question is, but I guess the question is, doesn't this statutory language, even if they're not entitled to the $14,000 by right, assuming the lien is valid, which I think we have to in this case given the record we have, assuming the lien for $14,000 is valid and assuming the first lien holder still has some interest in it. They may not be able to force the city to pay them back, but unlike me, I can't come and ask for the $14,000, adopt an ordinance, give me the $14,000. But this statute specifically authorizes the first deed of trust holder to do that, doesn't it?
The language that you suggest would seem to me it would be a violation of an ipso facto law in that the two-year statute for them asserting a claim ran. That's why the money was held for 2 years. That was the statute of limitations, and once that statute of limitations run, they no longer have a claim to that money. So the second or the predicate for that last sentence would never exist. They could not come forward and show they had a valid lien.
I think where all of the questions you're getting and the answers are a bit talking past each other, that last provision says that if Jones people show up and they go, look, you know, the heirs are all over the United States, we finally found them all, and yeah, it was never paid, and here's our testimony, and it's clear it was never paid. The statute clearly says if the government wants to give them the money, they can. The statute, however, and this is the part I don't like, says, well, if you wake up that morning and decide not to give it to it, just stick it in your coffers, even though your lien is on the entire amount.
The statute is the problem. You cannot just simply take it from a valid lien holder who has a constitutionally protected right.
Well, you could. I'm sorry to interrupt. You could, as has been pointed out, if you're giving it to the prior lien holder. But if the prior lien holder doesn't show up and is never going to show up and you're not going to give it to him anyway, even if he does show up, then it's nothing but a trick. You get to keep it and laugh your way all the way out.
Well, the city doesn't get to keep it, correct?
Yeah.
And not put it in their coffers.
But the problem we're all struggling with is, what happens, no matter what we decide, if the Jones people show up tomorrow and go, you know, we finally found the heirs, and daggone, the $14,000 wasn't paid. We're going to ask you for it back?
I'm sure a clever lawyer could figure out a way to sue my client for the for the proceeds for which they received that they shouldn't have because they were an inferior lien holder.
To avoid the constitutional question, could we read the statute as the $14,000 that the trial court set aside for the first lien holder satisfied that lien, and the money was held for a minimum of 2 years for the benefit of the priority lien holder, and if it didn't show up, that lien holder forfeited the money to the city?
Yes, and I think that was what I was trying to suggest, probably inartfully, is that they have lost their right to assert that there is any lien. It's been extinguished.
Well, right.
Well, you just conceded something away there. Under your argument, as I read your brief, they don't forfeit it to the city. They forfeit it to whoever else is in line,
which would be
your client.
Correct.
The city has no property interest.
It has no property in at all and cannot take it. And in this case, the city has taken it.
Your view of this is not that the lien holder, the first lien holder, was satisfied and then forfeited it. It's that you had the right to it all along because they never showed up.
I'm willing to go either direction on that. If the argument is that they got it, it was satisfied, they didn't come and get the money, that means that money's still available as surplus.
Not if it's forfeited to the city, which under Nelson is a possible, if there's no subsequent lien holder, is clearly constitutional under your argument.
Nelson is a case about due process, obviously, and what it says is if you give everyone due process, how did we get due process in that option?
You got all the rights to the proceeds that the second position lien holder was entitled to if every lien was fully satisfied.
If that was a valid lien. Let's look at the situation.
But you didn't challenge in the proceeding below that it wasn't a valid lien, and you didn't challenge that on appeal. So aren't we stuck with the assumption that the $14,000 is a valid lien?
Your Honor, I can say on the record that was objected to, and it was specifically reserved, if you look at the statement of facts, that we still have the right to make a claim against those remaining proceeds. It wasn't adjudicated. So in my view, that's not been an adjudicated issue.
So it could be a valid lien that was extinguished by the two-year statute, and then the government's got the money. They don't have any interest in the money at all.
Correct.
They got all of their bill paid.
Correct.
And they can say to themselves, well, if the Jones show up, we'll give it to them if we feel like it. So the question is, does the Fifth Amendment have a problem with that?
Yeah, I have a problem with that in terms of the Constitution. In terms of the Constitution has a problem with that. If you looking at the most recent Tyler claim case, we have an interest in the entire equity.
I think that's the part that was missed in some of the briefing. I'll ask your colleague on the other side. Your interest is not in the 7,171. Your interest is in the entire scope.
Correct.
of the deed and the lien that was filed, which is the entire property, the beneficial
Correct.
Interest in the property. Can I switch gears for just 1 minute?
Yes, sir.
The statute, this is not something the briefs helped me with. The statute says this is a bill in equity proceeding. Well, that is a historic proceeding that has 1,000 years of English background to it. And it does involve things like interpleader actions, what we would call modern interpleader actions, that adjudicates rights among competing claimants. I mean, that's one of the reasons for equity, is to be able to do that. But that really wasn't done below. You made the argument it should be done, but it wasn't done below. Would one remedy that you're seeking be, or have you, if you've preserved it, that you should be given an opportunity to litigate the validity?
Correct. Yes.
And if there are Joneses out there, it's like a deck action. If there's any Jones out there, they can show up. You give them all the due process notice you can, and they don't show up.
Correct. That's exactly where I was going with the due process. We haven't had due process because we did everything that we could do throughout to protect our rights. If they hold on to the money and say we're holding it for future use, I see my time is up.
With the Chief's permission, may I ask one more question? Right. So there are two issues in this sequence of questions. There's the takings issue, which is not a procedural due process
Correct.
Issue. And there's procedural due process, which is, well, maybe you can take it, but you just got to be fair about it, you know, give them some hearing, give them evidence, give them witnesses, et cetera, give them a court. You clearly have preserved the Fifth Amendment point, and it's a powerful point, I might add. I'm asking you now, was it very clear to the trial court that that trial court needed to say to him or herself, itself, really, I'm in a bill of equity situation, I need to have evidence of whether or not this Jones lien is ever going to be reclaimed, because I'm not giving it to the government. They don't have any business taking this money. And I have no idea that if I gave it to the government, they give it to the Joneses if they showed up later. So I'll give them notice and take care of it. Did that argument get made to the trial court? Because it would blindside the trial court if we said, that's what you should have done.
The argument, if you, again, I think it's contained within the statement of facts, where it does suggest what was presented to the trial court. But yes, they were told that we have an interest in the entire amount, not just the $14,000.
Yes, of course, unless it's superseded by a prior lien.
Correct. So we need to have the right to litigate whether that is, in fact, a superior lien, and we have not had an opportunity to do so.
Okay, so that was preserved from your perspective.
I know it was argued. I would have to go back, since that was not a question I have to freely admit I did that I anticipated. I'd have to go back and look at the record to make
Thank
sure
you.
It was properly preserved.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I'm Deputy City Attorney Greg Lukanowski, counsel for Appellee City of Richmond. The issue in this case is whether the trial court was correct in its interpretation of a single statute, Virginia Code Section 58.1, 3967, when it denied, as Mr. Young has told us, his client Appellant Caudill's trust claim for funds which were paid into court for a superior lien holder.
Did the Caudill litigant ask the trial court to adjudicate whether or not there is in fact any evidence that the Jones lien is enforceable? Obviously, it's a valid lien. It's been filed. It's in the deed book. But is it enforceable? Is there anyone there to enforce it? Because obviously, they didn't show up when the proper notice was made for this proceeding.
That issue was not raised with the trial court.
Suppose they had, under your argument, because I'm reading your argument to be broader than this. Suppose they had said, look, of course, the Jones lien trumps us out. But they're not here in 2 years, and you can't keep it for eternity and then decide whether or not in benevolence of the government to give it to the proper people. So we need to do basically an interpleader, a bill in equity, and we'll find out. We'll make a deck action out of it. And if they don't show up now, then I'll hold that they abandon their lien. Was that ever presented to the trial court? Because that seems to me to be the way to handle these cases.
That specific issue was not handled in this case, but I have seen it handled in other cases in which an inferior lien holder, mm-hmm. actually an heir of the owner of the property, came forward and said, well, this lien was paid, therefore
it happens
the
all
heir
the
should
time.
Get the money.
I mean, people pay off liens all the time and don't go through the process of getting the deed book fixed. Okay, so one last question for me, hostile question for me. Is when I read your brief, it seemed to me you were arguing that, look, they don't have any property interest at all in the $14,000. And as soon as I read it, I went, that can't be right. Obviously, they have a property interest in the entire property. They don't have an interest in money. They have an interest in the race, and the race has been sold. So the priority statutes presuppose that competing prior lienors and subordinate lienors are talking about the same thing. They're on the same playing field. But you say, no, there's no property under the Fifth Amendment or the 14th Amendment because they have a prior lien. I just don't understand that argument.
Well, where a takings clause claim starts is by the plaintiff must show that they had a property interest in what was taken. What was taken in this case was the $14,000.
$14,000 is the sales price of the property. They had a property interest in the property, and they had a property interest in the proceeds of the sale by the very language of the lien, and of course by equity law anyway.
This court has held otherwise. As Justice McCullough stated 3 years ago in Johnson versus City of Suffolk, the existence of a property interest is determined by reference to independent sources of law, usually state law. So let's look at Virginia Code and what it tells us about what Caudill Trust owned. What they owned was a lien. The city did not impair that lien. Caldwell Trust still owns that lien.
How can you say you didn't impair the lien when you took the money that they had a lien on? It seems like that's impairing it a bit.
Your position is they didn't have a lien on the first, although they had a lien on the entire property given the order of payout, the first $14,000 went to the first lien holder. Now, whether the first lien holder ever shows up to collect it or whether the first lien holder assigns it to somebody else or whether the first lien holder forfeits it to the city, they can't reach that until the first lien holder is satisfied.
Why can't they reach that once the first lien holder's lien has been extinguished according to 3967? Doesn't 3967 indicate it's extinguished if they don't file within 2 years?
No, it does not.
Why doesn't it if it is within the city's discretion to pay it to them? They no longer have a right to it if you all can decide it or the city can decide whether to pay it to them.
What 3967 tells us is that if money is unclaimed from the tax sale of a property, the city pays the money into court as it did in this case.
But it's not unclaimed. They claim it. And all they want to do is adjudicate whether or not someone under the priority statute can claim it ahead of them. It's not that they don't have something they can claim. They just got to have a contest between two claimants who are competing over the same residue or money paid out over the lien that they both had on the same property.
What happened in this case was the city sold the property. There had been no answers filed claiming any money by anybody. So what the city did was it took the money from the sale, paid off first the taxes, the legal fees, then it paid the $14,000 in for the first lien holder and the $7,100 in for Caldwell Trust.
But it didn't pay it into them, did it? It held it for them.
No.
To claim.
If I may, the registry of the trial court holds the fund for 2 years. During that two-year time period, that's when Caldwell Trust claim the funds by filing a motion.
What happens to the first lien holder if they don't file within the 2 years? The money is paid to the city, and the city can then decide whether it will pay it should the unknown beneficiaries show up. So if they can decide whether they will pay it, the unknown beneficiaries no longer have a property interest in those monies. Is that correct? Correct read?
The property owner, the lien holders, no longer have a property interest in that money once the two-year time period has elapsed.
Well, that's just the point. The Jones people, when they show up one day after the two-year period and they say, please, 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 you can just say, no, today is a Wednesday. We don't do this on Wednesdays. We're going to keep the money. And the statute allows you to do that. So how do they have a property interest to enforce at all? All they can do is beg you for the money back, and you can give them a gift. This statute is a clever way of getting around, seems to me, the decision that was just issued down by the U.S. Supreme Court.
The decision by the U.S. Supreme Court was very different. Why? The decision by the U.S. Supreme Court involved surplus to a property owner. As Chief Justice Roberts pointed out in Tyler versus Hennepin County, what happened in that case? Property is sold for $40,000. $15,000 goes to the locality for payment of taxes and legal fees, leaving a surplus $25,000. Chief Justice Roberts pointed out, well, who owns that money? That case cited the Magna Carta to go back for over 800 years of common law that the surplus goes to and is property of the property owner. And a vagary of Minnesota law could not change that. Chief Justice Roberts also pointed out,
don't you think a mortgage company having a lien on a property has a property interest in the property?
No, they have an interest in the mortgage, and that property interest is enforced
in the
foreclosure.
Okay, they don't have a property interest?
They have a property interest, yes, as part of the bundle of rights.
A lien, by definition, is a property interest. That's how we define it.
The lien itself is the property interest, that is true, not the money.
It proceeds from the lien or simply the sale of the lien. It doesn't lose its interest when it becomes cash. If that were true, we would have a condemnation case, and we say, well, you could have asked for condemnation recovery, but we just sold it to somebody else.
Counsel, going back to Justice Powell's question, where you seem to say that they have no interest at all, I can't go to the city of Richmond and say, give me the $14,000 by ordinance today. But they can under the statute, right? The General Assembly has specifically authorized the city of Richmond, if it chooses, may not choose to give the Jones folks the $14,000. They're not authorized to give it to me. So clearly Jones has some interest. It may not be automatically enforceable. It may not be enforceable over a contrary decision by the city, but they have an interest that the general public does not have in that $14,000.
I mean, an interest to beg? I mean, is that what they have?
I'm sorry, an interest to?
To beg the city to give them the money.
What we
they have
know,
no right to it.
What we know from the statute is, it's clear. If money is paid in the court, as the city did, as the trial court ordered, and it goes unclaimed, the city then may claim it, and then we have this final
sentence.
So is
it your position that the Jones heirs, or whomever the successors in interest are to the Jones lien, if they showed up after this hearing at City Hall and said, we'd like our $14,000 and we think we can prove that it was never really paid, would you be able to say, well, we may or may not give it to you, but we recognize that you do have a property interest in the $14,000. Would you say that? Or would you say, no, you don't have a property interest?
I'm saying
you
that
you forfeited it by not filing within 2 years.
The money is cheated to the city at this point. However,
would the Jones claimants have a property interest 2 years and a day to claim the $14,000 in cash out of your bank account?
That's a very good question, because there's clearly an interest in the statute. I write in the statute for the Jones heirs at this point.
Would they have a property interest in claiming the $14,000 2 years and a day?
I don't know if that would be defined as a property interest or not. It's a very good question.
So you don't have a position on that?
On that, after the 2 years have elapsed?
Right. Do they have a property interest in claiming the $14,000 after the forfeiture of the two-year statute?
What I know is the statute makes clear that the Jones party could claim it per the statute. Whether or not that's per se a property interest,
I don't see how it is, if it's entirely within the discretion of the city to say, yeah, we'll do this, or no, we don't want to do that. I mean, a property interest, you have a legal enforceable right, as opposed to you can come begging and say, well, you know, in your mercy, city, give us the money. That doesn't sound like a property interest.
And assuming that they don't have a property interest, the Joneses, how could the city ever take priority to those funds over the Caldwells?
Because the Virginia Code tells us it does. The Virginia Code tells us after 2 years of the money sitting in the registry of the court, the city may claim it.
Well, the Fifth Amendment says something slightly pushing back on that. So putting aside the statute, the question is, does the Fifth Amendment incorporated through the 14th say, yeah, no, government, you can't pull that one. You got to give it to whoever's in front of you that has a property interest in it, if it's not your money otherwise.
We know that there's the 1956 New York City case holding that surpluses, as long as you've had procedural due process.
Talking about Nelson?
Yes.
Well, okay, great. I don't know if Nelson helps you. I think it hurts you.
What procedural due process did Caldwell have to the $14,000?
Caldwell received notice of the city's complaint after the money had been, after the sale, after the funds from the sale had been deposited with the court. Caldwell filed a motion to receive its $7,100 on his lien.
To the 14. What procedural due process did they have to the 14?
Before the 2 years had expired, when the statute says the city should get the money, Caldwell filed a motion requesting that it also receive the $14,000, and that was the order from the trial court that we're here about today.
So they did preserve it. They flat out said, I want the 14. I want a little bit of hearing to find out if it's a legit lien or whether it's one of dozens we deal with in real estate practice all the time. They just sat there and no one actually filed their proper documents to take it off.
Yes.
Regardless of what they argued below, the trial court clearly found, as a matter of fact, there was a valid $14,000 lien in first position. That explains everything it did. If it didn't make that factual finding, nothing it did makes sense. And no assignment of error challenges that factual finding, correct?
Yes.
Are they challenging whether there was a valid $14,000 lien at the beginning, or are they challenging that the statute extinguished that lien and now they have priority over the city to that $14,000? Isn't that their argument?
I believe Caldwell's argument is found on page 15 of their brief, but when Caldwell has written, the unknown Jones beneficiary rights, that's the $14,000, if any, terminated for failure to file a claim. I agree with that part.
That's exactly what Justice Powell asked you.
But leaving the Caldwell Trust lien is the only valid lien of record in the disputed tax sale proceeds, that's not true, because you'll note Caldwell gives us no citations questioning the city receiving the money under the statute. And that is also true in the reply brief.
By statute, the tax lien wasn't the first lien. The tax lien was given priority by statute.
Yes.
So if the city has a lien on the $14,000 by operation of statute, that can be okay.
Yes.
But it doesn't.
Only if
because
it doesn't violate the Constitution.
No, it does not violate the Constitution, Madam Justice.
It's got to, because they've already gotten their money for their lien. The tax lien had already been paid. So it was extinguished.
May I answer that very good question this way, which is, run a thought experiment where instead of a city tax sale case, Caldwell Trust had enforced its judgment lien by moving to sell the property. What would have happened then? First money out would have been from the sale, legal fees, then city taxes. After that, next paid would have been the $14,000, then Caldwell. Well,
no,
what happened?
Next paid would only be paid $14,000 to Jones if he's in the courtroom or whoever is in the courtroom. But if they're not there, it is, and they'd be given notice, they forfeit the lien. We don't hold open bills in equity for sales of property for eternity, which is what the statute seems to do for the city.
Only if there is an action to quiet title that's brought by whoever's attempting to enforce the lien, that's true. Though what I've also seen happen is the money will be held by the court.
In a judicial, I'm sorry, Chief, may I ask one last question? In a quiet title action, to be sure what you're saying, but this is not a quiet title action, but quiet title issues arise all the time in judicial sales of property. I mean, all the time. And almost every circuit judge on this bench has seen that before. And what we do is we adjudicate it. We just don't go, oh, there's a lien here. Okay, who should I give it to? The government. That's convenient. The statute says that. We litigate it to find out if that prior lien is enforceable. It's obviously valid. It's in the book, and no one's claiming it's a fraud. So you have three liens in this case, a tax lien, a first preferred, and a subordinate. And the first preferred doesn't show up, you get your lien fully satisfied, and they don't get their lien fully satisfied. Why should you get the money as opposed to them?
Because Virginia Code Section 58.13967 says if money has been paid into court and goes unclaimed, the locality may claim it.
That's a great answer. My second last question, what does the Fifth Amendment say? The Fifth Amendment say, oh, we're good with that, no problem.
Fifth Amendment tells us that as long as there has been due process of your property that has been taken, I would argue Caldwell Trust property is its lien, not the money. A lien is not money. A lien is a right to collect money. Not the same thing.
Thank you. Appreciate your answer.
Thank you very much, counsel. This court is adjourned.